Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
Welcome to the South Cars Conference number 96140. Connection established.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast.
Good evening, everyone. This is South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This car server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by KB8ZGL. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com and for our digital operation at www.voip.southcars.com. Your net control for this session is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. My name is Kathy. My location is Vero Beach, Florida. So this is the Thursday Night Thematic Open Forum, or TNT for short. The program on this evening's TNT will be quite informative and interesting, we hope, for all concerned. We have a special guest this evening who is a forensic scientist. So at this time, I would like to introduce our special guest this evening. His name is Arman, and his call sign is AJ4IC. As well as being in the trenches as an active up-to-the-elbow CSI for 20 years, Arman was a faculty professor of forensic sciences and criminal justice studies here in Central Florida at the university for just shy of 5 years, and still does some guest lecturing. He's still working at age 69 because he just can't sit around and watch the grass grow. Arman works at the Orange County Sheriff's Office Forensic Lab there in Orlando, been there almost 15 years, and previously was with the Massachusetts State Police, from which he retired in 1997. Arman still has and still uses the only full-power HF rig he's ever owned, a Kenwood TS-440S. He owned it before he was licensed. SWL'd with old TV antenna for a couple of 100 years, the neighbor, friend, mentor, and Elmer, Bill Wade. It's K-R-1-I-J, shamed him into getting license, and he's always been grateful. So Arman works digital a lot, PSK, and can be found mostly on 17, 20, 40, phone, and CW. But just as likely all over the bands because of so many antenna restrictions in Florida. And I can relate to this, Arman. He uses a G5RV just lying on the roof, not the best, and can't play with the big kids, but it works for him. He did his undergrad, his Bachelor of Science, at Zoo Math in Boston, University of Math to most of us, physics, math, and chemistry. He chased that with a master's from Anna Marie College, also in Massachusetts, and then in a flash of brilliance, off to the University of New Orleans in Louisiana, just to pile it higher and deeper. So with a law enforcement career and a science love affair, he decided to lock up the bad guys using his brain. Some investigators can get a confession out of a turnip. He, on the other hand, was not as gifted in that department. Because he was better at the laws of science than the laws of man, he decided Sherlock Holmes was his hero and not Lieutenant Columbo. So with all of this introduction and this great background, let's begin this program this evening.
Well, thank you, Kathy, and good evening to you, to Gordon, and all to all the rest out there. Thanks for having me. My granddaughter likes to use my call sign as Apple Juice with 4 ice cubes, so sometimes we'll do that. I'm looking forward to tonight. Ought to be interesting, Kathy. Back to you.
All right. Thank you so much, Arman. So, everyone, what is forensic science? Forensic science is the application of a broad spectrum of sciences to answer questions of interest to a legal system. This may be in relation to a crime or a civil action. But in Roman times, a criminal charge meant presenting the case before a group of public individuals in the forum. Both the person accused of the crime and the accuser would give speeches based on their sides of the story. Now, the individual with the best argument and delivery would determine the outcome of the case. This origin is the source of two modern usages of the word forensic, as a form of legal evidence and as a category of public presentation. So, Armin, can you elaborate on forensic science for us?
Well, thank you, Kathy. I think you pretty much hit it right on the head. The term forensics, of course, is meaning the marriage of science and the law. This really hit home with me, and I never really gave it much thought. A few years ago, we all remember the Enron debacle, where people lost their life savings. I remember watching television one night, and they were talking about the FBI sending in forensic accountants to go over the books at Enron. When I heard that, it hit home. Oh my goodness. I don't care what you do. I guess if you put the word forensic in front of it, and you somehow work with some laws of science and the laws of man, somehow you connect them up, I guess you can be a forensic anything. We, of course, have forensic odontologists. We have dentists who specialize in bite marks. And forensic accountants, as we just mentioned. We have forensic engineers that are used to try and figure out what caused a bridge or a building to collapse or something. And I guess the bottom line is that you can be a forensic anything you want. I chose this particular field only because it's my makeup, it's my DNA, it's my persona. I've always had an interest in science, and as a young trooper, I saw potential for connecting my love, both of them, science and law enforcement, and like you said, hooking them up and seeing what we can do. It's a great feeling when you're working with something and all of a sudden you get that moment, yes, got 'em. Alibis, stories, lies abound. They're all over the place. But if I have the ability to go to court and say, this is the DNA, this is the gun, this is the knife, this is the bodily fluids, this is the fingerprint. Oh my, you can't fight the laws of physics, laws of chemistry. We don't violate those laws. You can't do it. Let him sing and dance and wiggle on the hook all he wants. We got him. And that's why I got such a kick out of it. This is a J4, I see.
I want to throw it out to the audience and see if there's anyone out there that has a question of Armand.
Lima, Charlie, Bravo. Thank you, Armand, for doing this program tonight. KW4, Lima, Charlie, Bravo, Georgia, and over here in Orange City. I was listening, and you had mentioned you spent some time in the school system in Louisiana, and I was just wondering if through some of your education, was it in the field of Louisiana and Mississippi after some of the aftermath of the hurricane there? And, you know, I'm quite sure there was a lot of people identified through family members, but I'm quite sure there were some other folks that they had to use other means to identify, and I was wondering if part of that might have been some of your learning. And I have did some emergency medical work in the field, and what can I say, you know, experience is the best teacher. You know, there's so many conditions that jump out, you know, of the woodwork, so to speak, at you there. It causes you to say, yeah, I got it, you know. And I was just wondering that.
Thanks for the question, George. It's a good question. No. Is that quick enough? I did not do any work down there after the hurricanes and after the world basically ended for these people, sadly. No, when I was at the University of New Orleans, it was for the doctoral program. It was after graduate school, and that was many years ago. And when I was there, life was wonderful. The University of New Orleans is in a city called Metairie, Louisiana, which is a suburb of New Orleans. And that's where I started my doctoral work. It's irony because my advisor, my doctoral advisor, at the time when I was doing a specialty in blood spatter analysis, my advisor was Dr. Waldrip. Can you believe that? That was his name, Waldrip, and we were doing blood spatter analysis. Well, since I've mentioned it, I might as well tell you one other anecdote. Two medical examiners back here in the Orlando area, we had a very talented, very, very, very gifted man who was our chief medical examiner. His name, are you ready? Dr. Gore. Who'da thunk it, right?
So KY6V, come aboard.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Gordon here, KY6V. Hey, my real question, but when you hit the subject of forensic medicine, you said something last night that really caught my attention, that everybody's putting forensic in front of their talent, and you mentioned a forensic carpenter. But you also mentioned something else that caught my ear, and that was the influence of television programs today, the talk about DNA, other measurements used in the forensic field are influencing, disturbing, causing problems in the courts. Would you care to touch on that in at least a light manner, if it's going to be covered further, sir? Armin, over to you. KY6V, over.
Thank you, Gordon. Yeah, you have no clue, sir. Let me tell you, this television program has bit us in the butt. We, fortunately, here in the Orlando area, have a good rapport. Well, I guess we all do. We're all in the same ballpark. I guess we're all on the same team. All of law enforcement and all of the state attorneys who prosecute all these cases are smart enough that we have, in the past, sat down with them and actually given them a bit of a little game we play. When we're brought up on the stand to testify, once they go through pedigree and training and all this other baloney, just to establish ourselves as experts in whatever particular field we'll be going down, one of the things that we have trained our state attorneys to do is ask specific questions. They will say to us, "Have you ever seen the CSI program on television?" I said, "Yes, I have." "Can you do some of the things they do?" You know, and we have to debunk so much of that. The problem is the jury so often seems to think we can walk on water. We can do anything. If we move a body from a crime scene once we've completed our investigation, they want to know if we took dirt samples. "Well, I saw on television, by taking dirt samples, you could tell where he came from." And I mean, it just gets crazy. It's not that these people are stupid. The jury of our peers are just that. It's our neighbors and our friends and our relatives, but they just don't have any clue. Television is killing us. Television is, you can see, looking at them, number one, there's probably four people who do everything. They're experts in ballistics and blood spatter, in DNA, and everything in between. They all wear Armani suits. They all drive Hummers. Oh, boy. You should come out to a crime scene sometimes. There can be absolutely nothing further from the television image than reality. It's a mess, it's nasty, it's rotten, it's dirty. could never in a million years do that job in an expensive suit. I see the women running around in three-piece suits with high heels. The crime scenes are immaculate. Forget it. Not the case at all, Gordon. AJ4IC.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much for coming aboard, and thank you, Armand, for your answers. I'm curious, and maybe you can answer this for me, Armand. Do the people in forensic, you for example, in Fort Pierce, Florida, where I teach, we had a bad school bus accident first part of the week. A bus driver turned in front of a semi. One boy was killed on the bus. Five were sent to hospitals, and they are in critical condition. 15 more were hospitalized. Do in that type of accident and what happened? It's not really a crime scene, I don't think. But do they go out and send all the forensic team out to collect any samples?
Yeah, I do remember hearing that on the news, Kathy. That was a terrible, terrible thing. The answer to your question is yes and no. Once again. When I was with the state police in Massachusetts, we did investigate all homicides and all potential fatal traffic accidents, those that were definitely fatal, and those that could go that way. And you're right. Down here in Florida, I was introduced to something new. We have here something called a THI, Tango Hotel India, the Traffic Homicide Investigator. These are troopers, police officers, and deputy sheriffs who are specially trained to reconstruct accident scenes. They determine, they'll get samples of the road surface and determine the coefficient of drag. They'll look at the tires, they'll look at the mass of the vehicles involved, and try with science, and here we are back in forensics, with science, try to determine this vehicle with this mass traveling in this direction, was doing this, was doing that, and try and reconstruct the accident that way. I did not do that. I have never been trained in traffic homicide. We have people who were, but we used to work side by side up in Massachusetts. Down here, it's handled by the THIs almost exclusively. I would imagine in the case of something very serious that engineers probably come in, automotive engineers, and I guess once again, we're talking what? Forensic engineering, I guess, if you want to use the term. They may not be hired in that capacity, but that's what they're doing, looking at the laws of man, the laws on the books, and looking at what they have at the scene and tying the two together, coming up with accidents that an eyewitness doesn't exist, so nobody can tell us exactly what happened. But with the laws of physics, they can come pretty close.
Okay, let's give Armand our second question. And this has to do with DNA. DNA, to me, is quite interesting. There's types of DNA. There's DNA profiling. There's DNA analyzing. Each of us has a unique DNA profile or fingerprint. And what I found out is we have two types of DNA in all of us. And hopefully, Armand, you can explain that a little further for us. And you can ask, tell us, do plants and animals also have the DNA that they have two types? It would be nice to hear about their DNA. I always hear authorities checking for paternity. They're checking the DNA. Generating a DNA profile usually involves analyzing an individual's DNA for chromosomes. Statistically, no two people, but what I found out, Armand, is identical twins. They have the same DNA, but all others are likely to have the same number of repeats in all of these STRs, and I want you to explain that to me as well. DNA profiling. It's also called, like I said, testing, typing, or genetic fingerprinting is a technique employed by forensic scientists like Armand to assist in the identification of individuals by their respective DNA profiles. So DNA profiles are an encrypted set of numbers that reflect a person's DNA makeup, which can also be used as a person's identifier. Although 99.9% of human DNA sequences are the same in every person, enough of the DNA is different to distinguish one individual from another, unless they're monozygotic twins, and you'll have to let me know if I pronounced that right, and what exactly are those type of twins. DNA profiling uses repetitive, and that means repeat, sequences that are highly variable, called variable number tandem repeats, and that's called VNTR. Particularly short tandem repeats are STRs. So VNTR loci are very similar between closely related humans, but so variable that unrelated individuals are extremely unlikely to have the same VNTRs.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you're right, Kathy. There are two types of DNA. You're absolutely right. One is called nuclear DNA, and it has nothing to do with atomic power. We're talking about the nucleus of a cell. And the other is called mitochondrial DNA. Here's the funny thing. You women are so, so totally cool. Mitochondrial DNA. Well, let's look at cells in the body real quick, like the average human. Now, at 6 feet five and 250 pounds, I'm probably off that chart. I'm about the size of a refrigerator. But the average human has about 60 trillion cells in their body. Each and every one of them has within the nucleus of those cells complete DNA, and in the mitochondria area, that's called the cytoplasm. Let's look at a cell in a body, kind of like a fried egg. The nucleus, of course, would be the yellow. The white is what we refer to as cytoplasm. That is part of the cell that is not part of the nucleus. That's pretty straightforward. Okay, now then, getting back to women. In mitochondrial DNA, the father has nothing whatsoever to do with that. You and your siblings all have identical mitochondrial DNA. And, taking this the next step, if we have an unbroken chain of females, mother to daughter to daughter to daughter, and on down the line, the great-great-great-great-granddaughter has the same identical DNA, mitochondrial DNA, as her great-great-great-great-grandmother. Case in point. A few years ago, you may recall, in the news, as well, actually some years ago, some elderly woman in Russia was alleging to be the sole survivor of the royal family, Nicholas and Alexandra, back in 1910, 1908, something around there, where the entire family was ruled, was wiped out. She was alleging that she was one of the daughters who escaped. Well, the Kremlin, of course, is a big museum. They had things there that belonged to the old royal family, the Romanovs. And from hairs on a hairbrush, they were able to do a with the mitochondrial DNA, they were able to prove she was, in fact, not at all a Romanov. Just some old lady that was either had criminal intents, or she was just a little soft, I don't know. But mitochondrial DNA just passes on. And also, your brother has the same mitochondrial DNA as you do. The difference is, he cannot pass it on. It ends with him. So his children will show no mitochondrial connection to the grandmother. This is good if we have an unidentified body and we think it might be this person or that person. We can get, if it's a female body, even if it's skeletal, we know it's a female, we can tell. We can get surviving relatives, females, or if we suspect it might be one particular person, we can find a sibling, regardless of the gender, we can do a mitochondrial match. Now, the funniest thing about this is each individual cell, all 60 trillion in your body, only has one chromosome in the nucleus. But in the mitochondria, there are thousands and thousands and thousands. So, mitochondrial evidence is far more present than nuclear. Here's the strange thing. Nuclear DNA is less expensive and easier to type than mitochondria. Don't ask me why, because I am clueless. In talking with Gordon yesterday, one of the things I mentioned, I hate to use the analogy, but you have to kind of look at CSIs and forensic people kind of like physicians, if you will. Give me a little wiggle room here. When you come out of medical school, you sort of know an awful lot about a lot of things, but you're not really an expert in any one thing. So after you're resident and after you do a little general practice for a while, oftentimes they specialize. They become cardiologists, surgeons, whatever. Well, it's the same way with CSIs. In the sheriff's office here in Orange County, our Class A latent examiner is a former CSI who fell in love with fingerprints and went on to specialize in that area. Our chief ballistician, same thing, fell in love with guns, case markings on the bullet, lands and grooves, and on and on and on. Again, a former CSI. I am, at this time, working on computers and imaging and enhancing imaging. That's what I'm doing right now. Because, frankly, at my age, I'm sick of jumping in the ditches. So, we all get exposed to a whole bunch of stuff. Quite often you find something that really catches your fancy, and down that path you go. We also, of course, have a small army of CSIs who love doing what they're doing and don't specialize, but remain, if we can use the term, general practitioners. They can do that for years and years and years. We don't all go off on a tangent. Some do, some don't. Anyway, I hope that answers you, Cappy. AJ4IC.
Gordon, KY6V, I have a million questions, but I'm not going to tie up the net. I'll throw two of them at you, if I may, sir. The first I was going to ask about hair follicles and whether they can be personalized to a particular individual, and you sort of answered that for me already in this Russian demonstration or subject that you were covering. I'd be interested in knowing, be it hair follicles or DNA itself, and I'm going to combine these two questions together. Is there a shelf life on this? If the hair follic has been dormant and removed from the anatomy for a great period of time, can you still get a DNA off of it? And how about a body? Can you get a proper DNA off of a body after it's gone through rigor mortis? Can you dig one up 100 years later and say, aha, he was related to Gordon Smith or something like that?
Yes, Gordon, you're absolutely right. Here's the thing. hair follicles, we absolutely, positively can get DNA. Do we always succeed? No. The material is there. Here's the funny thing. I told you in each cell we only have one shot at nuclear DNA. If we don't get it, that's the end of that story. Then what we'll do is go to the cytoplasm, or the white, the egg white. There we can get mitochondrial DNA. Nuclear DNA tends to degrade and die rather quickly. Mitochondrial DNA seems to last a lot longer. To answer part two of your questions, we have successful, I say we, of course it had nothing to do with me, the science of which I am a part, the science has been successful in obtaining DNA from mummies from Egypt, and probably daddies too. But, yeah, is there a shelf life? Honestly, I don't know. Those people who work specifically in DNA would probably be the ones to ask that, but what we do is we test. If we're successful, life is wonderful. If it's not, we'll try something else. I don't know that anybody can look at something and rule it out right off the bat. I think they just give it a shot. Sometimes they luck out, sometimes they don't. AJ4, I see.
Thank you for that. I just need clarification on one point. Am I getting the understanding that the DNA, the nucleus, or its surrounding matter does not decay if you can get it out of a mummy?
Yeah, it absolutely. We have something that old, skeletal remains, or in the case of a mummy, what they try to do is they go into the pulp of the tooth, or they try to get into the marrow of the bone. That seems to be the areas where mitochondrial remains are easily, I don't know if that's the proper term because I don't do this, but let's say rehydrated. Maybe they can get some dust from the middle of your femur and mix it with some magic elixir and from that extract DNA. I truly don't know that. I have never worked in DNA. I am aware of it. I know how to gather samples at a crime scene if we're going to use DNA. But truthfully, I've not gone down that path. That is a whole bag of worms unto itself.
So I'm going to throw it all the way to Connecticut. WQ1I, we appreciate you coming aboard this evening.
Well, good evening, Kathy. WQ1I here in Connecticut. Very interesting topic tonight. I didn't have any questions as of yet for Armand, but I did have some comments. For you, Kathy, you expressed some interest in this topic and wanting to learn more about it. And there's a book that I read many years ago. It's called The Seven Daughters of Eve. And it was written by a geneticist, I think an Oxford geneticist named Brian Sykes. He's a pretty famous guy in the field of genetics nowadays. And I think he even did some of the work on that Romanov family that Armin was talking about. But in this book, The Seven Daughters of Eve, he uses mitochondrial DNA, sampling people from all over the world, where he basically establishes that everybody on this planet can be classified as coming from one of seven progenitors. And by using this information and this mitochondrial profiling, he maps out the migrations of different races and where they all originally came from and who's related to who. And so it's a really interesting detective story on the one hand, but he does a really good job, too, of explaining the mitochondrial DNA and how these things work and it's something that you might want to check out, The Seven Daughters of Eve by Brian Sykes. Now, the other thing I wanted to comment on was a question that Gordon had earlier, and Armand did touch on the answer, and that was the effect of CSI on television that has on juries. And what's really kind of sad about this whole thing is, you know, DNA and other forensic science evidence is an incredibly powerful tool. It's changed the world of crime scene investigation. It's allowed people who have been wrongly convicted of murder and rape to go free years later, even when the crimes were committed before we had the DNA technology to be able to do this. But what's happening, sadly, in the court system is people watching CSI have gotten in their head that if they don't have some kind of scientific forensic science in evidence in a particular case, that they just feel they don't have enough to convict. And you can have an incredibly strong circumstantial case. Circumstantial evidence by defense attorneys, you can even hear it the way they say, oh, this is strictly a circumstantial case. Circumstantial cases are very strong. Circumstantial cases rely on multiplication of statistics, one coincidence after another, that even the defense attorneys mock, in a mocking tone, oh, there's no real evidence here. It's a circumstantial case. Well, circumstantial evidence is powerful evidence. It has the power of statistics behind it. It can be more reliable than so-called eyewitnesses, where people think they know what they saw, but often don't. And what's unfortunate is the juries nowadays, after watching CSI and shows like it, are getting it into their mind that if they don't have DNA to point to someone in particular, that it makes the case a weak case or an unprovable case, and that's really unfortunate and not a good thing for our system of justice.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Circumstantial evidence is evidence. Slice it up any way you want. If that's the best you've got going for you and there's enough of it, you should have no problem. However, we must remember the American system of jurisprudence. We have 12 people sitting in the box. And all the defense attorney has to do is to inject a little bit of doubt into the mind of juror number 7. And if that little old lady, that retired Sunday school teacher, doesn't buy the whole package, the defense wins and the defendant walks. That's the way it works. What can I say, A.J. Simpson? And words that choke me up, gags my throat. The one we had here in Orlando, right? The whole world knows about that, Casey Anthony. We went into that court, a lot of people, put a lot of time, very professional people. We had the scrutiny of the world on us. We went in there confident. Jury just decided otherwise. That's how the system works.
But let me throw it out to the audience.
Being from Mooresville, Indiana, I was wondering if it would be possible to dig John Dillinger up and find out if he's really buried in his grave. He's buried here in Crown Hill Cemetery. And some of us hope and think and whatever that maybe they actually shot the wrong guy. And he survived the Biograph Theater. So, if you don't find that too far afield, I don't know who wants to take it, but thanks everybody. Howdy everyone. And this is Kilo 9 India, Lima Golf, Indianapolis, Indiana, home of the world's greatest race course, and the graveside of John Dillinger.
Armand, how about coming aboard and maybe making a comment to Bud.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. Well, honestly, I don't know, but thinking of what we've already said, if we were able to successfully get some information from an Egyptian mummy, I should think John Dillinger would be fresh meat by comparison. Along the same, I made a quick note here. What the heck? National Geographic. If you do some research on the net, National Geographic has some kind of a program where you can submit DNA samples, epithelial cells, usually from a swabbing of your cheeks within your mouth. Epithelial cells are a great source of DNA, and National Geographic has some kind of a program that I read about where they, it's a little expensive though, I think it's about $75, but if you submit a sample to the proper people, they can tell you after a period of time that you are 5% African, you have 6% Asian blood, but you're mostly Northern European, and they can nail it down, and it goes back quite a ways. So there are people who are doing that sort of thing. Someday I'd be curious to do that myself. I think I'm French, but I have no idea. I could have had a relative who was an old Chinese horse wrestler. I don't know. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there. Back to you, Kathy. AJ4IC.
Thanks for that comment, and thanks for the comment about the National Geographic submitting DNA samples. And Six Victor, if you can come aboard with your comment.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kathy. Gordon here, KY6V. But I want to point this for a moment to Brian. You know, when you do an autopsy, are there basic things that you're looking for? Do you detect ingested arsenic indicating foul play?
Oh, my goodness. Remember, folks, I'm just a simple general practitioner, I guess, if you will. Armand is the specialist. But yes, during post-mortem exams, autopsies, which are usually done by two individuals, both doctors, usually a medical pathologist who is an MD or a medical examiner who is an ME, who is more of your special forensic medical doctor. And there is a very set procedure in which they do the examination. Each individual practitioner has their own way of doing things, but they basically all do the same format. The body is looked at. Blood is drawn for toxicology. And of course, depending upon what your coroner, your police investigation, is what they're looking for. Most generally, natural death. Occasionally, poisonings. But there is a very specific plan of attack. And then your specialist come in to play. Does that help, over?
Is there a shelf life? Is there a period beyond a reasonable period of time that your findings cannot be found properly?
The body will start decaying very, very, very quickly, immediately after death. Several days you can still do a somewhat of a reasonable examination. But as time goes on, it becomes harder to get, and of course, it tends to get a little gross. Armand, would you care to comment further on this? Would this be a subject that you would be familiar with? Over.
Well, Brian, of course, I mean, this is your bailiwick. You do this far more often than I do, but to answer your question, yes, of course, I'm in total agreement with you. Case in point, the Kaylee Anthony case we had here in Florida that made news all over the world. Dr. Jan Garavaglia, who is our chief medical examiner here in Orlando, Dr. G, ruled Kaylee Anthony was a victim of homicide. Oh dear, how the heck did she do that? Well, was there a knife found in the skeletal remains? No. Big rock tied around its neck or something? Uh-uh. No bullets. How did she come up with homicide then? Well, stop and think about it for a second. This is what, a 5-year-old girl, I forgot her age already, with duct tape on her mouth, in a plastic bag, in the middle of a swamp? You think she committed suicide? I don't think so. That's how that particular case was ruled. Dr. Garavaglia was asked specifically the cause of death. Was she choked? Was she poisoned? Was she strangled? And the answer is, don't know. Because, as Brian said, we need soft tissue for that. Stomach, skin, whatever. Looking for residue, chemical residue. In the absence of all that, when all you have is bone, sometimes you can get lucky and find trace elements in the bone. But not always. But still, legally, you can rule it as a homicide. Because we know darn well she didn't put herself there. AJ4, IC.
I'm going to throw it over to KY6V for just a moment, and then we're going to go in and we're going to talk about fingerprinting.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. I just have a quick question of Armin. DNA, is it now reached the stature of being similar to fingerprinting? Do you have computer databases that where DNA information has been placed that you can draw on just like you can fingerprinting at 3 gigs a second, and you guys don't have to do much thinking of it. You take these 8 trillion DNAs and the report comes out and says, well, here's the difference. Now, when it does and specifies one particular person, can you take that DNA further? And I'm not trying to be comical here, but can you tell whether a guy or the gal should have a red nose or a green ear? Or can you only tell that they are different and that is the person? Armin, over.
Okay. First, let me address fingerprints. When I was a young trooper, we used to roll fingerprints in ink on cardboard. Everybody who got booked, we did 3 cards. One went to the FBI, one went to records, and one stayed with the jacket, as we called it. What has happened in my lifetime, in all of our lifetimes? We now have a magnificent system called AFIS, Alpha Foxtrot India Sierra. That stands for the Automated Fingerprint Identification System. And what it does is the FBI now feeds all these fingerprints into AFIS. We can go to a crime scene and lift a fingerprint. We plug that fingerprint, if it's a good quality, we'll plug it into AFIS. AFIS will come back and say, sorry, we have no clue who that is. Oh well. 6 months down the road, we have a car burglary. We raise another fingerprint. We put it in the system. System comes back and says, sorry, have no idea who this is. We can carry the story on forever. Down the road, another crime, another scene, another latent. We put the fingerprint in. The computer comes back and says, I have no idea who this is, but there's 2 other people looking for him. This person is wanted for this, wanted for that, wanted for this. So it's like death and taxes. Eventually, it's going to make a connection. today if you want to be a scout master, if you want to be in the medical profession, if you have a gun permit, if you are in military, if you're working on secure information, you will be fingerprinted at some point, and they will put you in the system. And if your previous life ahead of you as a kid got you into trouble, when they put the card in, your whole day is going to be ruined, mister. Okay, that's AFIS, wonderful system, a computer for fingerprints. We now have a computer for DNA. It's called CODIS, C-O-D-I-S. That stands for the Combined DNA Indexing System. Right now, the only people who are in the database are convicted felons. If you are arrested for a crime and you're in jail and you're awaiting trial, you will get a physical at the jail. They'll take your fingerprints. They'll take your photograph, yada, yada, yada. They will take DNA, maybe epithelial cells, maybe blood, who knows. But they don't put it in the system. Here's the difference between CODIS and AFIS. Not until you are a convicted felon will that information go into CODIS. So down the road, rape investigations in particular, we could get any bodily fluids, obtain a DNA, run the DNA into CODIS, bang. If our suspect is there, the party's over. Love these computers. AJ4, I see.
Thank you very much, Armin. There was one thing that was not answered. Does the DNA, can the DNA be taken any further as to what characteristics of this person are different?
Honestly, I don't know, Gordon, to tell you the truth. I know they are able to look at certain locations called locus on the chromosome. And they know in this particular, and they know these areas. They know just which area is what. They can tell if a particular individual is perhaps prone to a certain type of disease. I can't imagine. Maybe this is too much Star Trek. I don't know. But I can't believe it's too far down the road where I, having a 14-inch nose, will have my DNA looked at, and they will see exactly where my nose chromosomes are, and they will do a splicing. They will take Michael Jackson's, well, no, we can't do that. That was man-made. they will take somebody else's nose and splice it into my gene. That's too late for me. But then they can do an in vitro fertilization, and my children will not have a nose that looks like a banana. I don't know that they can custom-make children yet. I have a hard time believing. If they wanted to, I'll bet you they could. I really believe that. I truly do. But since I don't work in DNA, and that is not a field that I'm really, really comfortable in, I know enough just to get myself in trouble.
Oh, I love that answer, Armin. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Actually, my next question of Armin was going to be about fingerprinting, and I'm still going to go in a little bit with that. So, George, KW4LCB, I think you had a question for Armin. How about coming aboard and asking your question?
Good evening again, Armin, and let me thank you again for being here there. You mentioned that you're now into the forensics of graphics, and are you, well, I guess you really don't have to answer this. It probably won't if you don't want to, but are you presently involved with this new filming we've been noticing lately on our local news here in Central Florida here tonight? You know, they were showing bumps on the head and all, you know, and I know different types of enhancements, and you know, is this the type of science you're into now? KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo, and I was wondering also the DNA banks there, and you answered that pretty well there. So, you know, nowadays a lot of doctors and different investigation group, medical investigation groups, want your permission to use your DNA or test your DNA, and I was just wondering about that. There is that doesn't become part of the pool later on, you know. So I was wondering about those kind of things, if you would be so kind. But KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo, back to you, sir.
Well, if I understand you correctly, George, no. If a doctor, and I'm not familiar with this, but if a doctor for whatever reason wants a piece of your DNA, say epithelial cells from within your mouth or something, I have no idea why the heck they'd want that, unless maybe they're looking to see if genetically you may be predisposed to a certain type of disease or medical problem down the road. I honestly don't know. One of the things that the hue and cry always comes up with is that we are getting into creating designer babies if we go down that route. I don't know that I'm so wound up in that field the way some of them are. Being in science, perhaps I just look at things differently, but you got to listen to their side of the story. I don't think it goes anywhere near as far as it could. I got a sneaking suspicion that there's an awful lot of controls in place. What is it? Something just popped in my head. What is it from umbilical cords that they get that is stem cells? There you go, stem cells. This coming down the road, I would imagine, is, wow, it's open-ended. There's no end to this. How far are we from the tricorder like they have on Star Trek, you know? Tell you everything there is to know about you. I wouldn't be surprised. And let's take it one more step. What about if we could get DNA from an ear of corn and somehow find the location that controls the size and wheat and barley and go over to third world nations? The hunger problem is a thing of the past, all through science. What if we could grow ears of corn that are as big as your thigh? What if they weigh 2 pounds apiece? Good grief. I wish the heck I was a lot younger, because there's an awful lot of fine stuff coming down the road. I don't doubt for a moment. Love to be a fly on the wall. AJ4, I see.
Yeah, buddy. It reminds me of an old song I heard years ago. Plastic ladies pushing plastic babies down the street. Maybe I can get a spot on the wall, see how it's all coming down. Thank you, KW4, Lima, Charlie Bravo, back to Net Control.
All right, thank you, George, and thank you, Armand. So, WA1NXI, how about coming aboard and, if nothing else, saying hi?
Well, good evening, Kathy, and everybody aboard. One of my favorite TV shows is NCIS, and one of my favorite people on the show is a forensic scientist, and I often wonder how much of that stuff is actually real. But I was wondering about the DNA. I just had one question. If you're an identical twin, is your DNA identical to, or could they tell you apart? But anyway, great net, and I'm enjoying it a lot. And maybe I'll have some more to talk about when you get to the fingerprint part. I got a little bit of practice at that in my younger years, Kathy.
Oh, sure. Very simply. And you are quite correct. Identical twins, as the term implies, are identical. Fraternal twins can be two males, two females, or one of each. Fraternal twins means the mother has released two eggs, and two spermatozoas found their target. So we have two placentas, we have two pregnancies, we have two individuals. Don't forget what we said about children from the same mother and the same father. If they're fraternal twins, there's a good possibility they won't even look alike because of the bazillion possible combinations. However, when we get into identical twins, we have one egg released. We have one spermatozoa that gets lucky. We have one impregnation. Little by little, they divide, they divide, they divide. And then one day, for reasons that medical science doesn't know, it splits in half and becomes two. There's only one placenta. There was only one impregnation. So, basically, they are clones. They are identical. Being siblings, of course, they share a common mitochondrial DNA, but being identical twins, they also share nuclear DNA, dead on indistinguishable. If we go to trial and we have a solid DNA evidence, and at the trial, twins show up, the state just drops all charges, because you can't prove which one did it. AJ4, I see.
Yeah, that answers the question and makes me wish I was a identical twin. Just kidding there, but WA1NXI, back to net.
Well, we hope you enjoyed part one of our podcast on the exciting life of the CSI. To download part two, please visit our website, www.waveguides.ca.